I wouldn't say it was my plan, you know, but I was aware of the fact by the time I was 25 or so, there was a great deal of American life, daily life, that didn't get into our literature. In fact, the first interesting thing, really interesting thing, that I read about a Detroit production line was in Journey to the End of the Night by Celine, a French writer, who actually was in the United States and was in Detroit. Why did it take a guy from another country to see that there was something astonishing about this? Because we were looking elsewhere. Americans and English both grew up with such a sense of the bucolic, of the rural, of the beauty of nature, et cetera, et cetera. And the cities were puzzling and difficult to write about. Take a city like New York. You spend a week here, and you say to yourself, how the hell does it work? Where does the food come from to feed 8 million people? Where does the rain go when it builds up? How does this work? How do people go in and out? I mean, the complexity is fantastic. How does Wall Street work? How come those in those big buildings, they got guys who are making my life miserable? I mean, it's mysterious. If you live in a small community or in a on a farm, where does the milk come from? It comes from the cow. Where does the water come from? Well, it rained and we saved it. We, you know, or we got a well, we dug the well. You're so much closer to the sources of your own living. Those questions don't puzzle you. Once you get used to a particular city, you might as well be living in a beehive. It seems to have the structure that it needs, and it does function. And, you know, now that I live here in Brooklyn half the year, it doesn't puzzle me in the least. So every day you live here is different, and I like that. My days are much more varied in Brooklyn than they are in Fresno. And I like that for a certain length of time. Goes on too long, I get back to Fresno, where everything is more or less fixed, and there are very few temptations. And so I go in my study, and I write almost every morning. And the phone hardly ever rings, because I need silence. But there's a lot of times you can't shut everything out. I mean, I grew up as a writer with my sons in the house, and they were capable of making a lot of noise. And I, at that time, I used music to shut out their sounds. I used ragas. Ali Akbar Khan was my favorite shut out the noise music. And I could turn the volume up and not hear them. I really wasn't hearing it. And I wasn't hearing my kids beating the crap out of each other either. So it was perfect. That was an aid to inner silence. About 10 or 12 years ago, there was a long period where words weren't coming. And a guy had told me, forget his name, another poet, that he used my poetry every morning of his life. He would go to a diner and he would open a book of mine and read a poem or two, and that would get him into the voice that he was striving for. Now, whether he was telling me the truth or not, I don't know. At any rate, I thought, it apparently works for him. He's finding something there. So I began, before I tried to write, I began to read every morning. I discovered rather quickly that the best thing to read was not American poetry. The best thing to read was poetry in translation, because there was no temptation to take the words as they were. I was just getting the imagery, because that's all I really wanted. I wanted the imagery. And there were certain poets that were absolutely fantastic for this. I think the best one was the Italian 20th century poet, Cesare Pavese. He got a book called Hard Labor. And those poems, which had largely a rural setting, but were not in any way a romanticizing of rural Italy, because the peasants were in it, and their hard life was in it. And the hard labor was the labor they did. And there were some poems that were situated in Torino, and they were about industrial people, workers. He's a wonderful poet. I would read him and I'd get, oh, there, that image. I remember once I read a poem of his with a seagull in it. And that's all I needed, was the seagull. I saw that, wow, I know, I have a poem in me that has a seagull in it. I haven't written it yet, but I'm going to write it today. I'm going to write my first seagull poem. And my seagull was tied to an experience I'd had when I lost my way on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley in California. I was supposed to get someplace, and I'd taken the wrong turn. I didn't know where the hell I was. And I saw a guy in a field. Because by and large, I was seeing nobody. The far west side there, before you get to the coastal range, is very sparsely populated. And I saw a guy in a field. And I parked the car, and I walked over, and I didn't know what language he would speak. He looked like he might be looking at him in the way he was dressed, with a hat with a wide brim, that he might be Mexican. There's so many Mexican Americans and Mexicans living in the valley. And I said, hello, or hola, or something. And the guy came over, and he said, can I help you? What's the matter? What do you want? And I said, I'm lost. I'm trying to get to so-and-so. And he said, oh, yeah, I can tell you. Oh, yeah, you're about 15 miles in the wrong direction, but that's okay. And he said, you see what I'm doing? And I said, no, what were you doing? He said, he was holding a shovel. He said, I'm burying a seagull. Sometimes they get lost, and they come down in the valley, and they don't know where they are. Sometimes they starve to death. They don't know how to live here. They're coastal birds. And I thought, oh, what an incredible idea. So, well, Pavese's seagull took me to that experience, and that experience took me to something else.